And I was going to tell about how I got started. I first heard about this from a friend named Richard Haynes. Richard's been one of the guests on these calls, and his conference call is in the archives. And he told me about David Hudson in about 1995, and about a month or two before I went to Portland to see David Hudson at his Portland lecture. And what we did is I took several people with me. Richard went, and my friend Jim went, and my brother went, and somebody else, I believe. And Jim was just nodding throughout the whole thing. He was just, everything made sense. It was, this stuff is the real stuff. This is, all of a sudden, everything that had happened to Jim suddenly made sense. And so Jim, and so...
Carry on, Barry.
So Jim apparently had already discovered all of this. And I'll talk a little bit more about what Jim discovered in a bit. But basically by 1996, in August, Jim was making his own Ormus, making it from metal. He was making it from catalytic converter beads that had mostly rhodium and platinum in them. And he had a bottle of this stuff on his, his lab was in a garage, and on his lab bench, he had a bottle of this stuff, and he took a magnet and moved it around under the bottle, and that was that. He just did that, and he asked me if I could feel anything, and I said, no, I don't think I feel anything. He could feel that it was repelled by the magnet somewhat, but I wasn't sure if I felt anything or not. And this was a professional Nalgene chemistry container, a special chemically resistant plastic, and very well sealed. And I didn't feel anything. So he moved the magnet around again, and I didn't think I felt anything. So I moved a little faster, and I still wasn't sure. You know, maybe it's your pulse in your fingers making it wobble a bit like that. You know, and I was holding it, and he was moving the magnet under it while I held it. So I thought, well, maybe I felt something, maybe not. We set it down, and then I went. He had something in the refrigerator behind us, some stuff that was in the freezer, and this stuff, he said, when the Ormus was in the freezer, he called it mono, but he said when this stuff was in the freezer, it would, as you got it colder, it would evaporate. It would move away. It would go to a gas. That was very usually things when they get colder, they liquefy. This was a liquid that would, as it got colder, it would go into a gas, and he could smell it. Jim was very sensitive to this liquid or the Ormus minerals in the air. He could always tell where they were. One time, he took him up to north central Washington to visit the Essene, and as we were driving along, there was a stream off to the side, a couple hundred yards, meters away, and but that stream's got lots of Ormus in it. And I said, how can you tell? And he said, I can smell it. So Jim was very sensitive and could always determine what was going on by smelling it, apparently. So at any rate, this stuff would go into the air in the refrigerator, and that's what we were talking about. And we turned back around, and this bottle that I'd held in my hand, and Jim had moved the magnet around under it. It had these three or four little dots of liquid on it, right on the top, as far away from the magnet as it gets. And this was a sealed container. Somehow that liquid had gotten out of that container, and it was a very energetic liquid, somehow, because it must have teleported. That's the only thing.
So basically it got out of the container and was sitting on the lid? Is that what you said?
Yeah. It was right on top of the lid, and somehow it got out. That was about the weirdest thing I'd ever seen in my life. And I didn't know what it was. Jim said it was rhodium and iridium, or rhodium and platinum from a catalytic converter bead from iridium. And being conscientious about my health and careful and all of that, I immediately went over and put my finger in it. And it had an oily feel to it. And so I tasted it. Now, that's the thing you do when you're careful about your health. You taste strange things. And by golly, it had a sweet, pleasant, kind of an oily taste, but a very pleasant taste and a sweetness to it. And it made my lips feel slick. And I rubbed my lips, rub them together, and they felt kind of oily. Kind of slick. Now, up until that time, all my life, I've had problems with chapped lips. My lips had often chapped regularly before then. But from that time on till now, my lips haven't chapped. I haven't got chapped lips once. So that's one thing that I immediately noticed that it did for me. But keep in mind that this was some very, very energetic performance. It was something that had enough energy to teleport out of a sealed container. We presume it would teleport. So that was my first encounter with it. From that point, till about, that was on August 25th, 1996. From that point until I finally met the Essene in May of 97, I just had occasional small amounts that ozonated Ormus and the Ormus wash water. Until I learned how to make the precipitate from the Essene. And,
with what effect?
Well, I didn't really notice a lot. But I've been on a pretty good diet for a long, long time. And this would have been probably 47 years old or 48 when this was happening. But, I'm still feeling good. And I still feel better than I felt back then. And but when I went up to visit the Essene on May 18th, 1997, he taught us how to make this stuff. And I made my first precipitate, wet method precipitate, using water from a hot spring, which is about four blocks from where I live. Baker Valley, where I live, has several hot springs on some kind of a fault line, and it has several hot springs in the valley. And this was called Samo Hot Spring. I just went over there and got some water and precipitated it. And I got probably a tablespoon out of a gallon of water, not very much. And then I started, I made some out of Baker City water. It was about May 27th of 97. And then I started using sea salt, mixing it with sea salt, and got a lot more precipitate, and it worked pretty good. I've been taking this stuff for 14 and a half years, probably, and I've noticed several things as a result of taking it. These things, and maybe I've been taking it as long as or longer than just about anybody, really. Very few people have been taking it that long, and many of the people who have taken it have, like Jim, Jim was also taking other things that probably weren't very good for him. And so I've been taking the Ormus and being careful about what I eat for a long time. So one of the first things I noticed, and I probably noticed this within 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 months, I noticed that I didn't have joint pain anymore. I'd had, you get to be in your late 40s and you get kind of creaky a bit, start getting creaky. And things kind of don't move as well as they ordinarily should. And I was having some common back pain. I'd have to go to the chiropractor on a regular basis and so on. And that started easing back. I still would go to the chiropractor, but I wasn't going once or twice a week like before. And then after taking it for 2 or 3 years, I noticed that I didn't go to the chiropractor at all. No, I don't. Why would I go to the chiropractor? My back doesn't ever hurt. And other things like, I had carpal tunnel in my wrist from doing a lot of mouse work on my computer. That disappeared. So those physical health benefits were some of the first things that I noticed. Another thing that I noticed, and I've got pictures on the website, on the Subtle Energies website. My brother, my younger brother, he's 4 years younger than I am. His face is kind of wrinkled, and he's 57, and his hair is really pretty well completely gray. Not totally gray. It's sort of a gray mixed with a little brown, but almost all gray. And my hair has got a little bit of gray in it, not much at all. And so, and he's not been taking the illness, and I have tried to get him to do it, but he just doesn't do it consistently. Another thing,
Barry, would you speak a little bit louder, please?
Oh, sure. Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. How's that?
Good.
Good. Okay. And it so it apparently helps hair color. It helps skin tone. I just virtually don't have any wrinkles at all. I've got crow's feet around my eyes, but I've had those since I was in my 30s. I've got pictures of my skin, my face, from when I was, 30, 35 or something like that. And it looks the same as it does now. So that's a pretty good thing, pretty helpful. And I really do appreciate it because going to the chiropractor twice a week, which is what I was doing for a while, that gets kind of old. And it's really nice to feel better than I ever felt in my entire life. But all of these things have made me wonder what exactly is going on. Why does the Ormus do this? What's really happening here? That's the question that I've always had, is what is really happening? Recently, Charles Dragoo, who's been on these conference calls, posted a video, internet, showing some Ormus made from azomite, which is a powder that's available from Utah for supplementing garden soils and so on. He made some Ormus from azomite, and he has a video on YouTube of this stuff jumping away from a magnet. Now, I made a video back in 97 or something like that of Ormus jumping away from a magnet. This was gold that Jim made from a from metal, and it would also jump away from a magnet. Nobody else has been able to get it to do that. Oh, there's somebody that got some iridium to do it, too. But Charles finally got that to happen. And that's an indication that this stuff might be superconductive. It might have quantum behaviors, quantum qualities. And these quantum qualities allow it to do things like teleport and levitate on magnetic fields. I suspect that they also do things like instantaneous, non-local communication. And instantaneous, non-local communication means that it's way faster than the speed of light. I mean, it's instantaneous. There's no time delay between the information going out and the information being received. And my favorite hypothesis is that this is what accounts for all of the special properties that the onyx has. This is why it's so good for plants, animals, and people, is because it improves the communication in the cells. And between the cells. And when that improved communication happens, the cells therefore work better. They can take nutrients in and expel toxins more easily. And we think, many people have postulated, and I think that this is the result of Ormus hanging out inside of water molecules and literally changing the shape, changing the structure of the water molecule, making the water have smaller molecules, which makes it wetter, which makes it able to pass through cell walls more easily. That makes it more hydrating. And this more hydrating water seems to be very, very beneficial in a lot of ways. So,
go ahead, Barry. You're talking about the hydrating effect of warmest water.
Yeah. And with that instantaneous communication between all of these water molecules that have the Ormus elements hanging out inside of them, you put a frequency in, you put information in, and it changes everything at once. The analogy that I like to use is it's like a dispatcher for a taxi cab company. And the dispatcher calls all of the cabs. He has a key on his keyboard, and he can call all of the cabs at once and says change lanes. And all of the cabs change lanes at the same time. And I think that's maybe like what's going on with this Ormus in water. It says change lanes. It says change the shape of the water molecule. And the water molecule can then respond to be more in line with whatever it is we're after. And it responds apparently to light, sound, and magnetic fields, even to thought, because there are Ormus containing water molecules in our brain. And in fact, there's a gentleman in Australia who calculated how fast nerve impulses would have to travel in order to play ping pong. And he figured out, well, we know how fast nerve impulses travel. They travel somewhere around the speed of sound. And he says that when he calculated this, that they would have to travel orders of magnitude, 10 times, 100 times, 1,000 times faster than they are known to travel in order to play ping pong, in order to notice where, to observe where the ping pong ball is with your eyes, and then respond by moving your hand with the paddle. He says that it's just, we're moving a lot faster than nerve impulses could possibly allow us to move. So he says that there has to be some other communication mechanism going on. And I think that this probably is this instantaneous communication system brought about by having the enormous molecules in the water and therefore in the cells. Further evidence of this has been observed by one of the Ormus, another Ormus conference call person, Dave Schneider. Dave has these devices called stir wands. And these stir wands, when you stir water with them or put them in with water, they change the structure of the water, making it wetter, more hydrating for the body. And this more hydrating water, apparently, can be beneficial because it allows the nutrients to go in more easily, come out of the cells more easily. So when the toxins come out more easily, hey, you may have a healing crisis or a Herxheimer, as it's called, Herxheimer effect. But it always allows those toxins to come out. And when they're out in the blood, a person may have the same symptoms that they had when they first fell ill, but they'll go out quicker. And then when those toxins are out, the illness will pass, and it'll pass more quickly than it originally passed, usually. So
Barry, what do you think actually happened for Jim in that story where he had an overdose somehow of that almost material that just sent him to such high-speed manifestation of his thoughts? What happened there?
Well, what happened with Jim, to go back to that, I'll tell a little bit of the story. Jim was using ozone to clean up mine waste. When he hit it with ozone, all of the toxic metals would drop out of the water. And his ozone was very powerful ozone. It was typically other people at the other ozone generators at the time were getting like 2% ozone. Jim was getting like 17% ozone. He was getting a lot higher level of ozone, and his ozone was much more powerful somehow. Maybe it was just the concentration of it, but I think that there was something else. It may have been, instead of O3, maybe it was O6 or O12 or something. We don't know for sure. At any rate, this more powerful ozone would rip apart molecules containing metals, and apparently would also destroy toxins. And also it looks like there's some good evidence that it would convert the metal from their metallic state into their ormus state, so that these elements no longer were metals. They were now ormus, rhodium, iridium, and gold, whatever. Jim was working with this with the catalytic converter beads that he converted into this green liquid that he moved the magnet around, and the clear droplets appeared on top of the Nalgene container. That was what he was doing, was converting the metallic form into the ormus using ozone. And so where he was with this is in the mid-80s. Jim decided that he wanted to make an ozone generator, about 1986. And I was working with him. He was also working on speakers and antennas and one thing or another. And I had some machine tools. And so I built the flat plates, the contacting devices where the oxygen went through an electric field, an electric plasma, and was converted to ozone. And I was making the little flat plates. Jim built the electronics, and I built that mechanical part. And Jim then moved away from Baker City, moved to Utah, worked with a lab there. But every once in a while, he would come back to work locally, just because he knew people here and had contacts here that he could work with and people in the mining area. He decided that he was going to help clean up mine waste. And he was working on a mine called the Bonanza Mine about 50, 60 miles away from where I live in the mountains. And it was in a mountain valley. And they were cleaning up these mine wastes, and they were having a great luck. He was getting he was getting all kinds of garbage out of the mine wastewater. This was water that was going to go back down the stream, you know. And I've been, at the time, I was doing environmental work. I've been doing environmental work for a long, long time. I've been doing organic gardening and doing environmental work since the 70s and 80s, mostly in terms of building houses and building insulating houses and making them more less energy intensive. And so Jim started using this to clean up the mine waste, and he was getting mine waste getting cleaned up real good, the wastewater. And they would get this stuff. What he'd do was he'd run the water over charcoal briquettes, run it through a long plastic pipe, spray it over charcoal briquettes, and as it sprayed down over the charcoal briquettes, fibers of gold would grow inside the charcoal briquettes. And nobody could figure out how this gold was getting inside the charcoal. We'd never heard of David Hudson. And somehow he was growing gold inside the charcoal briquettes. Well, Jim accidentally got his hands in some of this water that was spraying out from the pipe, one of the couplers on the pipe that was spraying down into the column of charcoal briquettes. This coupler started leaking and spraying out. Jim went up with his hands, was pretty high. He had to stand on a plastic bucket turned upside down. He went up to tighten this and got his hands in the water. And as soon as he opened his hands after this, he saw little fibers of metal, of gold, coming out the backs of his hands. And this was a real strange thing. This is the first I'd ever heard of what we later figured out was ormus. But this stuff, when it came out the backs of his hands, well, it hurt. Some of these fibers were an inch long, you know, and you'd pull them out, and you'd have an inch of, you know, an inch of gold and other metal alloy, and he was getting the same kind of thing from the charcoal briquettes. Well, what do the charcoal briquettes and the hands have in common? They're both carbon. Well, when I finally went to see David Hudson in 1995, and he's doing a lecture in Portland, Oregon, he said that there are three or four things that will help convert the ormus to metal. And these two things were sulfates, nitrates, carbon, and high-energy ionizing radiation. Well, Jim's ozone apparently was supplying this high energy as the ozone broke down into ordinary oxygen, was supplying this high energy and converting the metal or the ormus into metal, dropping out some of it into metal. But it could go either way, depending on how Jim treated the metal with ozone or treated the ormus with ozone to make it into metal. Whether he had carbon with it, whether he had sulfates with it, whether he mixed nitrates with it. So Jim started figuring out all of these ways to do all of this and started getting just amazing results. Now, all of this triggered an interesting event. Jim was making quite a bit of metal using ozone and his magnetic traps. One thing that Jim concluded was, if these minerals are superconductors and they levitate on magnetic fields, then you should be able to spin them in a magnetic trap and they will levitate and you can collect the portion of the water that levitates out. And, you know, this is something that Bo Long is doing with his stratification traps and so on. And so basically Jim designed the first magnetic trap, put it on a creek and spun the water, and stuff that came out was kind of a little bit oilier than ordinary water. He was able to convert enough of it to metal that he sold a good portion of it. He mainly sold it to a gentleman, sold it to, I think it was, AAA Precious Metals in Portland, Oregon. And a week or so later, after he sold, it was rhodium, after he sold the rhodium. A fellow in a suit showed up at, Jim was staying, when he come back from Salt Lake City to Oregon, Baker City, or to nearby, he would stay at a friend's house, a guy named Rod Hester. And when he was staying at Rod's house, this guy, after they sold $5,000 worth of rhodium, this guy came to the door and knocked on the door, and they actually said, "Say, boys, here you sold some rhodium. You're not going to do that again, are you?" That was scary. The guy was basically threatening them. And Jim said, "Oh, no," because Jim had heard that, yeah, you don't want to sell certain precious metals because they're controlled by a cartel. But Rod hadn't really heard this, and Rod, you know, started calling the guy names and cursing at him and better, and told him to get the hell out of here, and the guy left. 14 hours later, Rod headed for Portland to sell another batch of this stuff, this rhodium metal, and probably sold it. We don't know for sure, because on his way back, he had a fatal single-car automobile accident. He, like he'd been run off the road or something. His car ran into an abutment on the top of the Blue Mountains, and between Portland between Pendleton and LeBrand, and he died. And interestingly, they didn't find any money on him, and they didn't find any metal with him either. So it's possible that whoever ran him off the road also took the money or the metal, whichever was there. So from that, I became quite aware that it's important to keep some of this information kind of low-key. Jim had offered to tell me how to make metal, but I was consistently saying, "Hey, I don't want to know. I don't know how to make metal. Metal isn't something that's that important." And so I just started figuring out ways to use the magnetic trap and to use the methods that Jim used. One thing that when Jim got his hands in this stuff, he got really, really sick. And he was really sick for like 18 months. He would sleep 22 hours a day, and he was having, you know, weird psychic dreams of angels and talking to the biblical Abraham, and all kinds of strange things were happening. And he actually had to move back from Salt Lake back to Oregon, and actually moved in with his parents, his mom, moved to his mom's house, mom's and dad. They were quite old. They were quite old when he was born, and but he was they were more like grandparents than parents in terms of their age. And his mom really couldn't take care of him. He was sleeping 22 hours a day. She couldn't take care of him. Well, so Jim then moved to Portland, where his business partner, who was a lawyer, a guy named Rod, took him in. And he stayed upstairs at Rod's house. I was still doing environmental work. I was doing work, forest protection work and things like that at this time. This was about 1990. And Jim, I kept trying to call Jim, trying to get in touch with him. And every time I'd call Rod's house, the lawyer's house, he'd say, "Oh, Jim, he's asleep, taking a nap," and I never could reach him. So finally, I just decided I was just going to call every day until I got hold of Jim. And eventually, he happened to be awake one time I called, and he said, "Well, I got this heavy metal poisoning, and I got really, really sick, and I don't know what to do. The doctors don't know what to do. They say I have four times the lethal level of lead and arsenic in my system." Four times the lethal level? That's, why aren't you dead? I couldn't figure out why Jim wasn't dead with four times the lethal levels of lead and arsenic in his system. And so I went to my mom's health food store. She owned a health food store and was still running it at the time. And went through the books and found a book on how to get rid of toxic metals using hydrogen peroxide. and it's just a hydrogen peroxide detoxification process. And so I got the book, and I got some food-grade hydrogen peroxide, and hydrogen peroxide is very similar to ozone in some of the ways that it works, and we figured that something was going on with Jim, and that the ozone somehow, something related to the ozone or something was keeping him alive, and I thought, well, maybe hydrogen peroxide will help get these toxic metals out. We still didn't have any idea how the toxic metals got in. He just had his hands in the water spraying out of the coupler for a couple seconds. And, you know, his car was over to the side. He had a burgundy maroon-colored car. It, after this stuff sprayed out, it had a gold metal flake paint job on the side that was closest to the spray. That side, wherever the spray hit, some of the gold must have gotten into the paint, and it looked like gold metal flake paint job. So the carbon converted the ormus to metal, and we figured that maybe that the hydrogen peroxide would help convert the metal, whatever toxic metals were still in his body, might help convert them into something that the body could eliminate. And he started taking the peroxide, and within 2 or 3 weeks, he was back up and about and doing fine. He wasn't sleeping 22 hours a day. He was feeling a lot better, and things just generally got better for him. And so he started really researching this, because this was a whole lot more interesting than the ozone. This was a way of getting rich, making precious metal, potentially, or finding something that would, you know, cure toxic metal poisoning. He was using his ozone generator at the time. He was designing a ozone sterilization device to sterilize medical instruments. So that was, he had the medical idea in his mind. Plus, you know, once he took the peroxide and all of that, and he started getting better almost immediately, he felt that focusing on healing properties was quite beneficial. And that's when he started doing the ozonating the catalytic converters beads and converting them into ormus and making ormus precipitate. And I've got lots of videos that I took at around that time. And then one time when I went with Jim up to visit the Essene taught us how to do some other methods of making this. One thing he taught us was the wet method, where you precipitate this stuff by raising the pH to 10.78 out of seawater. And Jim would use that process when he'd made this stuff in an acid form, and then he would precipitate it out, and he'd get a white powder just like the Essene got, but he would make it from metal. So Jim developed several other methods of making it, and I also invented a method called the peroxide method, where you mix hydrogen peroxide with a precious metal and hydrochloric acid, and you can get it into a green acid liquid, and when you raise the pH, it'll precipitate out as a white powder. And Michael Burberry, who was another one of the conference call people, Michael has done this, used the peroxide method on 22 different elements and converted them into white powder. 22 different metals he's converted into white powder, an edible white powder. So apparently this is something that may work with just about any metal. And the interesting thing we found is that these elements in the ormus form are way more common than they are in the metallic form. So that's probably why they make up such an important part of the body and the body's health. Now, here's another interesting fact. Jim's experience with the gentleman who came and said, "Hey, boys, I hear you sold some rhodium," and his friend Rod's experiences as well, inclined Jim to be very secretive about all of this and to keep it as much under the radar and figure out other ways of selling any metal that he made and that sort of thing. It also confirmed my inclination to keep it quiet. With plants, it may not be so important. If we're enhancing the intercellular communication in plants, and that particular process makes the plants grow better, it might be a really, really useful, helpful thing for anybody that eats food, because if you can get plants to grow better by putting these minerals on the plants, and you can get these minerals easily from ocean water or any seawater, Great Salt Lake water or Dead Sea water or any natural sea salt, then we put these minerals on plants, then when people eat the plants, they'll be getting the minerals too. The whole thing will be, let's call it a grassroots sort of thing. You know, the grassroots sort of grow underneath the soil, and you don't notice how interconnected they are until you go to try to dig the grassroots out, and it's almost impossible. And so we wanted to keep this kind of low-key. And when I went to, I think it was the third time I went to visit the Essene in about 2000, he showed us some giant nuts that he'd grown on his tree, giant walnuts. The walnuts were the size of tennis balls. And, I mean, I'd never seen walnuts anywhere near that big. He had some walnuts nearby on another tree that were literally a quarter of the size, a quarter of the weight of, in fact, they were about a seventh of the weight. He had seven other trees that didn't produce as much walnuts by weight as the one tree that got the seawater precipitate. And obviously, a sevenfold increase in growth and productivity would be really helpful. Well, this was in the early 2000s. This is 2001 that learned all about the walnuts. Well, since then, things have changed economically, and we're going through some kind of tough economic times right now. In fact, there's a lot of people who are questioning our ability to get out of these tough times. There's also some other things that are going on, and they may be related. When gas prices peaked I think it was 2005 or something like that, people started starving. Lots of people. In fact, there were supermarket shelves in the United States that didn't have food, because our food is so interconnected with the availability of petroleum and petrochemicals to grow it and to transport it. So if people could grow more food locally, then that would be great. Now, when I met Dennis in Australia, what was that, 2008, Dennis? When did I meet you in?
Huh? You arrived on the 3rd of October.
2008?
Yeah.
Yeah. When I met Dennis, I traveled around several different cities in Australia and ended up in the Australian capital territory and did a presentation in Canberra. And when I was there, a gentleman came up that I'd met online previously, but he came up and introduced me, and I met him in person. And he was talking about how he was using a combination of effective microorganisms and seawater ormus precipitate, and he was selling an agricultural product. And when this agricultural product was put on the soil, they got tremendous increase in yield, and this was at the end of almost at the end of a 7-year drought in that area. And people were nevertheless coming up to him. Farmers were coming up to him after applying this stuff, and they were saying, where is all the water coming from? They couldn't figure out. He was, somehow, it was like this stuff was pulling water out of the air, or it was pulling water, or it was just really conserving well the water of plants and so on. And so that suggested that this, that these ormus minerals, which he was using in his soil, were somehow very beneficial for drought tolerance. They made the plants more drought tolerant. They made the plants, allowed the plants to hold more water or something like that. I have a shamrock plant in my kitchen window, south window, and I've had it for, I've had it since about 1985. I have a picture of it about 1985, not exactly in the same window, but in another south window. And this shamrock plant is huge. The stems and the leaves are almost 2 or 3 inches longer. They are 2 or 3 inches longer than typical shamrock plant leaves grow. And I've been putting ormus on it for maybe 5 years or maybe less. Well, recently I started putting trap water on it, and water from a magnetic trap. And for all the years that I've had this, I've been regularly watering it every 2 weeks, because every 2 weeks the thing would start getting real droopy, and all of the leaves, would, all of the stems and leaves would fall over and droop over the sides of the vase that it's in. And so I'd say, oh, that's, now it's time to water the shamrock plant. And I'd water it, and then I'd water all my other plants, because I use it as the indicator, oh, it's time to water my plants, my indoor plants. But when I started putting this tap water on this, it never got droopy. 3 weeks, it still wasn't droopy. 4 weeks, finally at 4 weeks, in a month, it started getting droopy again. It took, it required half as much water. And that is incredible drought tolerance. Half as much water and greater growth. Well, in the situation that we're in now, with peak oil or economic problems or global warming or global cooling or whatever is going on, being able to grow food, more food locally, seems to me like the very, very best thing we can do. Because whatever is going on, food from afar is going to be harder to get. If it's an economic problem, harder to get. If it's peak oil, transportation is going to make it harder to get. If it's global warming, flooding, or causing droughts, or whatever, it's going to be harder to get, because more of these croplands will be flooded or dried or whatever. So lately my focus has been to try to get people out and about, people in the world, people everywhere, to get them become more aware of how ormus can help them continue to eat. Most of the people that I know eat food. Maybe even all of the people, but I know somebody that doesn't eat food. Maybe not. And these people that eat, right now I think that continuing to eat may be a little bit more important than psychic powers or other things that the ormus seems to bring about. Although those things can help us be in the right place at the right time and get aligned, allow good things to happen. So my focus has been getting the word out about ormus with plants. Unfortunately, there's kind of a problem. People think it's too good to be true, or they think it's woo-woo stuff, or they think it's, you know, crazy somehow. It's really, really difficult to get this information to people. In order for it to really work, it's something that everybody has to know, or at least one person in every town has to know. So my interest now is trying to figure out ways to get this information to more people. Good.
What was it that Jim actually did that caused him to have that huge manifestation of his thoughts? I mean, you know, there was often, I mean, you made reference to the fact that Jim somehow got this, you know, that ozonated water on his skin, uh-huh. Right?
It wasn't
that.
That was Jim had that to some extent. Another gentleman had it to a much greater extent. This gentleman is a biochemist. He's on some of the Ormus forums. He wants to remain anonymous because he has an official job as a biochemist. And so he literally made some white powder of gold using David Hudson's method and annealed it and took 6 micrograms of it, very, very small amount. And the next year or 18 months of his life, learning how to control his thoughts, because whatever he would think about would show up almost immediately. And his habit of thought was not necessarily thinking of what he wanted. He was more often thinking of what he didn't want. So he would just basically have to be very, very careful and learn how to be very, very careful. Does that answer?
So basically what you're saying is that he did a David Hudson method.
Mm-hmm.
Would you enlarge on that a bit?
Well, he used the method that's in David Hudson's patent to make this from metal, and he used it specifically on metallic gold and converted it. And that was took a very small amount of it.
Why do you suppose that have you speculated on why he would get that effect and no one else has reported it?
Well, no one else has made it from metal using David Hudson's method that I know of. To some extent, one of the chemists that worked with David Hudson or worked for David Hudson had an experience somewhat like that. And to some extent, Jim had an experience somewhat like that. But my sense is that it improves the communication system so much that you get instant manifestation. That time delay in manifestation is what makes life tolerable for a lot of people. You know, you can think about things you don't want and not even, they don't even happen until the next day or so. But when you get that instant feedback, all of a sudden you say, oh, I've got to really watch what I think. And that's scary. And then more scary stuff will happen. So it gets into that realm of you get into a feedback loop, and pretty soon you just say, well, I'm going to just do mathematical equations in my head all the time. Because at least that isn't thinking about what I don't want.
Okay. So at least that cleared that up for me. Thank you for that.
Good.
So we're basically out of time. Any last question? Otherwise, I'm going to just wrap this baby up.
Oh, I have one more.
I have a question just about the last one. Would be what? Like, it's understandable how plants would go better, grow better, because their thoughts, their cells communicate better. But what's your speculation as to why this guy manifested so much more rapidly? Is it along the nerve cell? Is it?
Well, he was just in better communication with God, the universe, and everything. And so his improved communication, if he was thinking about having an accident, put him right there at that right time to have an accident, you know, or to almost get hit by the car.
And does it correspondingly make a person, say, more compassionate, more forgiving, more tolerant, or no?
Yes, it can, particularly if you decide that, hey, I'm doing this, and so is everybody else. They've got more of a time delay than I have, and so they don't get it. But I'm going to be more careful about what I focus on, what channel I tune into, and I'm going to focus my attention on feeling better, on the things that feel better, the things that are happier, the things that... The other day I was reading a lot of things about financial collapse, a lot of things about, and I read one article that said it's inevitable and our population can't be sustained, and and we're all going to die soon, you know. And oh, that kind of got a bit down from that. And I wasn't saying, well, yeah, Ormus will help, because Ormus is going to increase our population, or could, if people are healthier and live longer. And I didn't have an answer for it. So I got, and that day was just, it was just, I had a yucky day. It wasn't, you know, horrible things happening. It was just, I felt a little bit off. And then I realized, oh, it was because I was focusing on that and letting that, those thoughts, make me miserable. Usually, when I think of virtually anything, oh, Ormus can help. And I think Ormus will help a lot in a lot of ways for a lot of things. I'm absolutely sure that it's going to help us live long enough that we don't have to have kids to take care of us. You know?
But do you think it also would help? Does it help shift the psychology more to, like, greed or violence exists in the human race? Do you think it helps heal that or transform that?
There's been some recent comments on the Ormus forum, I think, about how people here are so nice. Have you read any of those comments?
Oh, well, I've noticed it just in the two or three people that I've spoken with from it.
Yeah.
Like you and Richard. But yeah, definitely, I get that. But my question is, from what you've observed and other people taking it, is that a trend?
Yeah, I think so. I think that people become nicer because you realize that if you are doing mean things, the chances are good that you're doing them because you're afraid. It's fear motivated. And if you're afraid, you're thinking of scary stuff. And if you're thinking of scary stuff and you're getting it instantaneously feedback on it, you say, oh, that doesn't feel good. I'm going to quit doing it. It's like the guy went into his chiropractor and he put his hand way behind his head and tried to reach down his back, and his other hand tried to reach down his back, and they got both hands clasped together. And I mean, one from going up his back and the other going down. He pulled and he said, "Doctor, it really hurts when I do this." And the doctor said, "Well, don't do that." And a lot of times it's just that simple. If it doesn't feel good, don't do it. And people are, I think, better tuned into that when they take Ormus.